Before I get started with the message today, which will focus on the Old Testament, I will point out an article in the latest Beyond Today magazine entitled, Can Jesus' Existence Be Proven from Sources Outside the Bible?, which is complementary to the message that I'm going to be talking about today about the Old Testament. So I encourage you to take a look at that if you haven't already. The title of the sermon today is The Birth of Israel. The Birth of Israel. Pardon if I do a little bit of coughing. How many of you have already noticed the allergy season has started? Yes. Tree pollen. I'm always amazed at how God's Spirit guides and directs the ministry to specific topics simultaneously. How many have already read the latest e-news from ministerial and member services? It was sent out. Just a few. In the latest e-news, Victor Kubik has an article titled, A Goat, A Bedouin, and the Truth of Prophecy. And I highly encourage you to read that. He describes the miraculous find of the Dead Sea Scrolls 75 years ago by a young Bedouin looking for a lost goat. Let me quote from that article. One of the greatest biblical discoveries of all time started with a goat. In November 1946, a little over a year after World War II ended, three young Bedouin cousins were combing the barren hills northwest of the Dead Sea trying to find their lost goat. The hills were pockmarked with small cave openings, which local legend said contained hidden gold or other treasures. One of the cousins wedged his way into a small gap. If the goat wasn't there, perhaps he would instead uncover fabled treasure. He did discover incredible riches, but not the kind he was looking for. In the cave, the young Bedouin found several old clay jars that were stuffed with ancient scrolls. He gathered up several and carried them back to their camp. A number of the scrolls that were miraculously found 75 years ago are today carefully preserved at the Shrine of the Book repository at the Israel Museum. A breathtaking replica of the most magnificent and possibly the most important scroll serves as the centerpiece of the Shrine of the Book. Like many of you, I've personally seen this marvelous exhibit. This is quoting now. Today, called the Great Isaiah Scroll, the original manuscript represents the only complete book of the Old Testament found among the first seven scrolls from what is now known as Cave 1. The scroll includes all 66 chapters of Isaiah and is written on 17 amazingly preserved sheets of parchment. The original is too delicate and sensitive for display, so a faithful copy serves in its place for viewing in a giant enclosed circle. Why is this important to us? Remarkably, the Hebrew of the Great Isaiah Scroll only has a few minor variants from other authoritative Hebrew texts which we use today. At the time it was discovered, it was at least 1,000 years older than other Hebrew copies. The great Isaiah scroll dramatically confirms the accuracy of God's word. Continuing to quote, on the 75th anniversary of the discovery of the now famous Dead Sea Scrolls, so-called because Cave 1 is about 1.5 miles from the northwest shore of the Dead Sea, we are persuasively reminded of the power and purpose of God in safeguarding his written word. All of the scrolls hold great historical, religious, and linguistic significance. I believe that God deliberately preserved this particular complete book of Isaiah, as well as other Dead Sea Scrolls, to emphasize how carefully the Old Testament has been preserved across millennia to us today. It also underscores how important the prophecies are that it contains, and perhaps most importantly, how we can have absolute confidence in the veracity of these written prophecies. The existence of the great Isaiah scroll lays out an important lesson and focus for us in the Church of God today, especially as we approach the Passover. Let's consider why. The discovery of these astonishing initial texts led to widespread archaeological interest. After the 1948 war following the founding of Israel as a modern nation, intensive excavations took place across the sun-scorched landscape. A total of 12 caves ultimately yielded 981 additional manuscripts and partial copies of Old Testament books and other writings. Thousands of written fragile fragments were recovered in the region. End of quote. Now, when I read this article 2 days ago, I was amazed. For months, I had been studying the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Jewish sect known as the Essenes, who were probably the ones that created the scrolls. I have literally bought every book I can find on the scrolls and the Essenes. Here's just a few of them. Apocalypticism and the Dead Sea Scrolls, Calendars in the Dead Sea Scrolls Measuring Time, Ancient Mysteries of the Essenes, The Lost Prophecies of Qumran, and Israel and the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm also studying an online course from the Great Courses Company on the Dead Sea Scrolls. So this study led me to take a greater interest in what's known as A-N-E, Ancient Near East, okay, and other recent discoveries validating the authenticity and accuracy of the Old Testament. One outcome of my study has been the Bible study on Moses, which I presented in East Texas on December the 15th. Some of you were there and remember that. I'm sure a copy of the Bible study is still available if you'd like to listen to it on our CD library. Now, I had no foreknowledge of what Mr. Kubik would write to the church this week when I began working on this sermon days earlier. This sermon examines new archaeological finds that validate the Old Testament. In particular, I have focused on the birth of the nation of Israel. This sermon draws on the research documented in a recently published book. The book is entitled Origins of the Hebrews, New Evidences of Israelites in Egypt From Joseph to the Exodus, written by Douglas Petrovich, that's spelled P-E-T-R-O-V-I-C-H. He's a professor of biblical history and exegesis at the Bible Seminary, an independent non-denominational 501c3 charitable institution of higher education located in Katy, Texas. He is an amazing scholar, reads hieroglyphics and so on. For some time now, I've been aware that most mainline archaeologists consider the stories in Genesis, Deuteronomy, and Joshua concerning the birth of ancient Israel and their conquest of the Holy Land to be either simply myths or, at best, wildly inaccurate. In fact, I mentioned that in that Bible study on Moses. You might say that if it's in the Bible, most biblical archaeologists don't believe it. They typically approach their archaeological work assuming that the Bible is not a source of truth. Articles submitted to peer-reviewed journals which validate the biblical account generally are rejected. And as a sideline, the book that I just referred to is a result of that. The professor is typically one who would write scholarly articles and submit them to scholarly peer-reviewed journals. Well, his research is constantly rejected. Not because of his scholarship, but because it supports the biblical narrative. In fact, someone once suggested to him, hey, why don't you write it in a book instead? You'll get a publisher to publish it then. And that's what he did. And that's what that book is about. It's his scholarly research that was rejected by most of these peer-reviewed journals that he tried to send his material to. So today I want to address the following questions, providing newly discovered archaeological evidence that proves that the Bible is true. Some questions to ask. Did the Israelites live in Egypt? Is there any evidence that Jacob and Joseph came to Egypt? Was Moses a real person? Some people don't even believe that. Was Moses really raised as a royal prince in the court of Pharaoh? Did he kill an Egyptian? And later, did he bring destruction upon Egypt and led the children of Israel out of Egypt? We'll briefly address these and other questions during this message. There are two very polarizing topics in the ancient Near East, that's the A&E, archaeology. One is the identity of the Israelite people before they relocated to Canaan. And the other polarizing topic is the Exodus from Egypt. And by the way, there's a lot of important archaeological digs over there in Egypt, but the people doing that are afraid to talk about the Hebrews being there because of the religious issues of Jews versus the Egyptians, okay? So this is one problem that squelches the truth, is that if they want to keep digging there, they have to be quiet about the fact that the Hebrews were actually there. Dr. Petrovic says there is no consensus on Israel's sojourn in Egypt or the famous Exodus from Egypt popularized by the movie The Ten Commandments in 1956 by Cecil B. DeMille and the Walt Disney Company movie The Prince of Egypt in 1998. Believe me, if you think that the Ten Commandments are accurate, You have another thing coming. That movie, that was a Hollywood movie, and there were so many distortions in that movie you can't believe. William G. Denver is an American archaeologist, an Old Testament scholar, and historian specializing in ancient Near East. Denver is the son of an evangelical pastor, was raised as an evangelical Christian, and became an evangelical preacher. However, he later rejected Christianity and converted to Reform Judaism, although he now identifies himself as a secular humanist and a non-believer. In 1997, Denver declared that the Israelite people never resided in Egypt before entering Canaan. He decried the outright non-historicity of the biblical events, suggesting that the Exodus account is not so much history as it is Haggadah. Haggadah is traditional Jewish literature. Another scholar, James M. Weinstein, proposed in 1997 that if it were not in the Bible, anyone looking for archaeological data from the Holy Land would conclude that whatever the origin of the Israelites is, Egypt is not the place. Ultimately, such positions are based on an argument of silence. In other words, due to a lack of evidence, one must conclude that the biblical narrative is not a historical account of actual events. Amihai Mazar, that's spelled A-M-I-H-A-I, M-A-Z-A-R, is an Israeli archaeologist and professor at the Institute of Archaeology of Hebrew University of Jerusalem, stated confidently in 2007, and I'm quoting him, "No direct evidence on the Israelite sojourn in Egypt and the Exodus can be extracted from archaeology," end of quote. In 2007, Israel Finkelstein concurred with Mazar when he wrote this, quote, "There is no trace of the early Hebrews in Egypt," end of quote. Well, thankfully, not every archaeologist or biblical scholar is so pessimistic, as many take the text as recounting authentic people and true events. Even so, for those who accept the narrative's historicity, disagreement abounds over the dates and the details. The most profound disputes are over the length of the Israelite sojourn in Egypt and the date of the Exodus. Now, the Bible plainly states that the Israelites departed from Egypt 430 years to the very day after Jacob and his household relocated there from Canaan. We read that over in Exodus 12 and verse 41. Let's take a look at that. In Exodus 12 and 41, we read this. "And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, on that very same day," that's amazing, "it came to pass that all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." Weinstein declared that unless new and better evidence for this event is forthcoming, the story of the Exodus cannot be considered a topic for productive archaeological research. In his book, Dr. Petrovic states that Weinstein should be very happy to know that new and better evidence of Hebrew origins in Egypt is available, thanks to productive archaeological, epigraphical, and iconographical research. A literal rendering of biblical chronology related to the Israelites' stay in Egypt requires an entry into Egypt in 1876 BC and a departure in 1446 BC. And that happens to be exactly 430 years. The Joseph narrative initiates the detailed history already prophetically revealed to Abraham in Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14. Let's turn to that. Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14. Then he said to Abram, "Know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years, and also the nation whom they serve, I will judge. Afterward, they shall come out with great possessions." Amazing prophecy. According to the research of Dr. Petrovich, Joseph actually served under two different pharaohs. Joseph first served as second in command over all of Egypt under Sosatris II. I'm going to spell that. S-E-S-O-S-T-R-I-S, Roman numeral 2. 1887 to 1878 BC, who can be called the abundance pharaoh. Sosatris II is the pharaoh that had the dream that Joseph interpreted. The pharaoh had no peace, wondering what this dream meant. It must have been a fantastic dream to cause such concern. The pharaoh's chief butler remembered that Joseph was an interpreter of dreams. He told Pharaoh about the Hebrew who had served as a servant of the captain of the guard, now in jail. Pharaoh immediately sent for Joseph. Joseph shaved and dressed appropriately. Joseph then appeared before Pharaoh. But at that point, Joseph already knew he would interpret the Pharaoh's dream correctly. Just as Jesus said in John 5 and verse 30, "I can of myself do nothing," Joseph, as a type of Christ, took no credit to himself. Before he interpreted the dream, he told the Pharaoh that it was not him interpreting the dream, but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that was giving Pharaoh the interpretation. Notice this in Genesis 41. We'll read verses 14 through 16. Genesis 41, verses 14 through 16. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him quickly out of the dungeon. And he shaved, changed his clothes, probably took a bath too, I imagine, and came to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it is said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it." Notice this. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, "It is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer in peace." Notice that after Joseph had interpreted the dream, Pharaoh understood that Joseph's God had given him this interpretation. We'll read that in Genesis 41, verses 39 through 46. Genesis 41, 39 through 46. You're pretty much there already if you've been turning to the other scripture. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, and notice this, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this," see, he recognized where it came from, "there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. We're going to be covering more of the proof of this in a minute. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh. And without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Wow. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name, and I'm not even going to try and Zaphnath-Paaneah. Okay. Certainly not an Egyptian. And he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. That's an important point, by the way. He went out. He was traveling. He didn't sit in the throne room. He was a busy, busy man. He went out over all the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now, during the 7 years of plenty, Joseph actually worked on many major projects to provide irrigation and the production and storage of grain. There were buildings built, forts built with bins. There was an irrigation canal created. All of this under Joseph. He was an amazing leader. Joseph had ordered that surplus grain be stockpiled in every city throughout Egypt. We see that in Genesis 41, verses 47 through 49. Genesis 41, verses 47 through 49. "Now in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly." And one of the reasons why is they converted dry desert land into productive cropland by building these irrigation canals and having water coming in from the Nile. "So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt and laid up the food in the cities. And he laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain and the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable." This is a massive project. "Now, after the time of plenty, a terrible famine came upon the land. And during this famine, Jacob sought food in Egypt. Joseph's brothers went to Egypt and interacted with Joseph, although they did not recognize Joseph. Eventually, Joseph revealed himself to his brothers, and Jacob then came to Egypt about 2 years into the 7 years of famine. The arrival in Egypt of Jacob is linked to the reign of Sosistris III. Okay, that's just like the last one, only in Roman numeral 3. S-E-S-O-S-T-R-I-S, Roman numeral 3, 1878 to 1840 B.C., who corresponds to the bibliohistorical figure of the famine pharaoh. So there are actually two different pharaohs. The one in the years of plenty died, then there was a famine pharaoh. Thanks to the preparations made by Joseph, the pharaoh gained considerable power. During the 1870s BC, the famine pharaoh used the stored food of Egypt to obtain much land. As we hear on TV, don't let a crisis go to waste, right? Well, that's what this pharaoh did. He took advantage of the crisis. He removed the magistrates from power that had ruled over what were called nomes, N-O-M-E-S. They were called nomarchs, N-O-M-A-R-C-H-S. The nomarch suddenly vanished from Egyptian records. All over the whole country of Egypt, these magistrates suddenly disappeared. The pharaoh initiated sweeping changes within Egypt's governmental structure, including the curbing of the various chief magistrates' power and the establishment of absolute power directly in the hands of the monarch. How did he do that? Well, he had all the food. Everybody had to sell themselves and their property to the pharaoh. He strengthened the central government, minimizing the power and influence of the feudal nobility. He completely reshaped Egypt's government and extended his dominion in Nubia, immediately south of Egypt. Around the middle of his reign, the rich provincial tombs, which were a mark of the nobles' power, abruptly ceased to be built. See, everyone, including the nobility, had to sell themselves to the pharaoh. He had all the food. The only exception, the priests. Thus, Pharaoh and his descendants all remembered how Joseph gave the monarchy such absolute authority, and as a result, they revered Joseph. This respect lasted until years later, a pharaoh arose which did not regard Joseph. Dynasty 18's first ruler, Amos, that's spelled A-H-M-O-S-E, is the king who did not know Joseph. And we read of this in Exodus 1 and verse 8. Exodus 1 and verse 8, if you'll turn over there. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Okay? That's the biblical account. This makes sense biblically because his family of Dynasty 17 lived in Upper Egypt. And remember, Upper Egypt is south, far removed from all the powerful hereditary rulers who had ruled Lower Egypt, which is in the north. The famine ended in about 1871 BC, roughly after 7 years of Sosthenes III's reign, came in. So in 1860 or 1859 BC, Joseph took his two eldest sons, Manasseh and Ephraim, to visit his father, who was nearing death. And we won't turn there, but that's in Genesis 48, verses 1 and 2. Genesis 48, 1 and 2. Jacob then told Joseph, this is a critical thing, that he was taking away Joseph's two sons as his own, who were born to him before Jacob arrived in Egypt, meaning Ephraim and Manasseh. That's in Genesis 48 and verse 5. Now, this action went beyond merely transferring the rank of Jacob's two eldest sons from Reuben and Simeon to Ephraim and Manasseh. They officially became Jacob's sons. Jacob then relocated Joseph's two eldest sons to live among his uncles, their Goshen. In 1859 BC, Jacob died. We see that in Genesis 49, verse 33. After living 17 years in Egypt, he died 147 years old. And we see that in Genesis 47, verse 28. With a great contingent of Egyptians, Joseph delivered his father's body to Canaan for burial. This is in Genesis 50, verses 4 through 14. God was involved in this instruction. Jacob had explicitly instructed Joseph not to bury him in Egypt, but to carry his body out of Egypt and bury him within the family burial grounds in Canaan, which task Joseph promised to carry out. We see that in Genesis 47, verses 29 and 30. The narrative later recounts the granting of the king's permission as the transportation of Jacob's body was accompanied by a caravan of family members, Hebrew elders, Egyptian elders, and servants of the king who traveled to Mamre for the burial. And that's in Genesis 50, verses 6 through 13. This is so critical. God made sure that Jacob didn't have a tomb built in Egypt, because that would have validated it for the world to see, just like we can't find the ark today, okay? But it's there somewhere probably, up on Mount Ararat or wherever. If they had built some monument, because remember, Jacob was a great man in the eyes of the Pharaoh's family, because he'd given them all this power over Egypt. He'd centralized all this power. If they had built a pyramid or some great tomb, probably be there today. So it was hidden from the world. But guess what? It wasn't totally hidden. It's now being revealed. Yes, they found a statue of a man. And the paint on the statue still exists after all these years. The man is wearing a coat of many colors. The colors are red, white, and black. Because there was no tomb in Egypt for this great man, they created this statue. And now it's being revealed to the world in Dr. Provitz's book. Now the two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, demolished the house of Jacob and replaced it with a far more elaborate structure. Ephraim and Manasseh built their home directly over the location of Jacob's house, implying Jacob bequeathed his own plot of land to Ephraim as part of the birthright he conferred on his grandson. This mansion's vast array of rooms probably began with the twin master bedrooms that Ephraim and Manasseh almost certainly occupied, and this is all being discovered. Joseph had become a very wealthy man in Egypt. Can you imagine that as number two to the Pharaoh? He had, you know, gold hung around his neck. He was put in royal robes. I mean, that was just the start. Joseph became a very wealthy man in Egypt. And his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, were raised in Egypt's highest circles. The new building was probably bankrolled by his wealthy father, Joseph. It's possible to cover all of the archaeological, it's virtually impossible, I should say, to cover all the archaeological proofs in this one-hour sermon. You have to read the book. Still, I refer those that are interested to Dr. Petrovic's book on the origin of the Hebrews. All of this is covered in great detail, in very scholarly way, with incredible numbers of references in the back of the book. The Exodus is linked then to Amenhotep II's reign, and I'm spelling that Amenhotep, Roman numeral 2, reign in 1453 to 1416 BC. The chronology for Egypt's dynasty 18 during Moses' lifetime is based on the astronomical evidence acquired from the Ebers Papyrus, a medical treatise George Ebers purchased at Luxor in 1873. Dynasty 18 encompasses the Israelite oppression and the entire lifetime of Moses, including the events of the Exodus. Among those who still worshiped the God of Abraham and had faith that a deliverer would soon appear were Amram and Jochebed of the tribe of Levi. They remained faithful amid the prevalent corruption. So despite the Pharaoh's decree to kill any male child by throwing it into the Nile, that's in Exodus 1 and verse 22, they were not afraid of the king's command. Notice that the decree was to throw the child into the Nile. This was the common practice of the Egyptians disposing of a dead animal. The crocodiles would quickly consume the dead body. And obviously, if a child was thrown into the Nile, crocodiles would consume it. Pharaoh's daughter was performing a sacred ritual in a holy place on the Nile near the temple. The waters there were considered sacred to the Egyptians. To be safe from crocodiles, the place was secured in a manner similar to a shark net. So who was this daughter of Pharaoh? Now, Moses was born during the reign of Thutmose I. I'm going to spell this Hatshepsut. Is Hatshepsut. May have been the sister or half-sister of Thutmose I. She qualifies as a very strong candidate for the Pharaoh's daughter who drew Moses from the Nile River. If she was responsible for saving Moses from the Nile, and later Moses killed an Egyptian and fled, to return later to free the enslaved Israelites and to cause the destruction of Egypt, would there be any evidence of this in the Egyptian records? There was a massive effort to destroy all records of Hatshepsut's existence. It was the intention of the Pharaoh to eliminate every trace of her image in all of Egypt. From one end of Egypt to the other, her name, her pictures, her carving, anything that represented her was totally destroyed. This had to come from the very top, from the Pharaoh himself. You see, there was a massive effort to destroy all records of her existence. It was the intention of the Pharaoh to eliminate every trace of her image in all of Egypt. According to Egyptian religion, removing the name or image of a deceased person was a direct assault on his or her spirit. For that person to live forever in the field of reeds, the body, the image, or the name must survive somewhere on earth. If all memory of that individual were lost or destroyed, the spirit also would perish, initiating the much dreaded second death, a total obliteration from which there could be no return. This act against her was an attempt to condemn her to oblivion, a fate worse than death for an Egyptian. If Hatshepsut raised Moses as her adopted son in the royal court, as is described in Acts 7, verse 21, you can see how angry the Pharaoh would be. After the loss of all the firstborn children throughout Egypt and the loss of the army at the closing of the sea, the Pharaoh would have returned to Egypt seething with anger, both at the loss of his firstborn son, a massive number of his population, and the entire portion of his army that he had time to muster for the pursuit of the Israelites. Exodus 14, verse 28. All of that would provide just cause to erase her memory from Egypt and remove her spirit from the afterlife. The Egyptian people would have supported this edict, since their rage undoubtedly rivaled Pharaoh's. And they also were mourning deceased family members and loved ones. The nationwide experience of loss also would account for the unified effort throughout Egypt to fulfill this defeated Pharaoh's commission vigorously. According to Moses, he who is sent, his destroyer to kill all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, that is, the firstborn of the king, of the prisoner in jail, of cattle, and other animals, which included all human and animal life. We read about that in Exodus 12, and I'm going to read verse 23 and then skip down to verse 29 and 30. Exodus 12, 23, and then 29 through 30. For the Lord will pass through to strike the Egyptians, and when he sees the blood on the lintel and on the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and not allow the destroyer to come into your house to strike you. And it came to pass at midnight that the Lord struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh, who sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of livestock. So Pharaoh rose in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where there was not one dead. While it may be impossible to confirm or dispute whether such a discriminating plague ever occurred, the archaeological record reveals evidence that may attest to the event directly. According to Exodus 11 and 12, at least four types of large animals were present at the largest city of the province of Goshen: cattle, sheep, goats, and dogs. The Israelites were instructed to slaughter sheep or goats that were less than one full year of age, to eat some of the meat, and to paint some of the animal's blood onto the doorposts and lintels of their homes, so that the destroyer would pass by their homes and not strike down any firstborn children within it. That's Exodus 12, verses 1 through 10. An Austrian archaeological team, and by the way, this is the largest archaeological activity in the entire Middle East. An Austrian archaeological team discovered shocking evidence of mass burials of bulls, dogs, sheep, and goats in pits that were dug. The vast majority of animals were sheep and goats. The fill of the burial pits contained only a few potsherds, probably reflecting the speed and brevity with which the burials were performed. The excavators noted that a long time span should not be assumed for the duration of these burials. After the firstborns were killed, there would have been many dead animals in need of a quick burial. The mass deaths of so many animals in the city would create the need for immediate burial for sanitary reasons. The care with which the burials were completed betrays the fear within the survivors after the horror they had witnessed the night of the Passover. Mass burial of animals' bones there, of sheep and goats. Some scholars argue that since there is an absence of any account of the Exodus in Egyptian records, it must not have happened. However, no Pharaoh ever celebrated a defeat. No Pharaoh ever built a monument celebrating his defeat. This absence of documents can be explained by the tendency to write comparatively little about foreigners, especially slaves. Nonetheless, the Hebrews not only exited Egypt in mass, but they were responsible for the extermination of the Pharaoh's vast army, the mightiest military force on earth at that time. The proud Egyptians should not be expected to have documented their humiliating defeat, which would smear their record and tarnish their glorious legacy. Why has the scholarly community not embraced the historicity of the account of the Israelites in Egypt for 430 years during the second millennium BC? The person of Moses in the royal court of Egypt and the Exodus? The problem is that until the publication of Dr. Petrovich's book in 2021, and he has references that current in his book, no scholar had presented any direct archaeological evidence of the Egyptian origins of the Hebrews. But now, thanks to productive archaeological, epigraphical, and iconographical research, detailed by Dr. Petrovich, new and better evidence of Hebrew origins in Egypt is available. And I have just barely touched the surface of what's in that book. The book's quite expensive in a hard copy. I think it's $40-$50 or something. But the e-book is available much less expensive, and that's what I use in my research, because I can do searching for words and be able to locate things quickly in the book. Today, the biblical account of the Israelite sojourn in Egypt from 1876 to 1446 BC and subsequent Exodus are sufficiently verifiable as historical. Just since the birth of modern Israel took place in 1948, has God allowed the discovery of both the Dead Sea Scrolls and new archaeological evidence validating the accuracy of the Old Testament. The Dead Sea Scrolls were 1,000 years older than what had previously been considered the oldest manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible. Before the discovery of these scrolls, the oldest complete copy of the Old Testament in Hebrew was Codex Babylonicus Petropolitanus. Sorry about that. From AD 1008. So that was the earliest copy, was 1008 AD. More than 1,400 years after the Old Testament was completed. Fragments from the Dead Sea Scrolls now close the gap by 1,000 years and left the world waiting to see if the text had been transmitted accurately. The answer came back. It was a resounding yes. The Dead Sea Scrolls demonstrated unequivocally the fact that the Jews were faithful in their transcription of biblical manuscripts. This reverence of the scriptures was summed up long ago by the first century Jewish historian Flavius Josephus. I'm going to quote Josephus. Quote, "We have given practical proof of our reverence for our own scriptures. For although such long ages have now passed, no one has ventured either to add or to remove or to alter a syllable. And it is an instinct with every Jew from the day of his birth to regard them as the decrees of God, to abide by them, and if need be, cheerfully die for them." End of quote. So, let me conclude by again quoting Mr. Kubik's article in part. Quote, "I believe that God deliberately preserved this particular complete book of Isaiah, as well as other Dead Sea Scrolls, to emphasize how carefully the Old Testament has been preserved across millennia to us today. It also underscores how important the prophecies are that it contains, and perhaps more importantly, how we can have absolute confidence in the veracity of these written prophecies."